Okay, last time I was here, now that I've been sick twice, I need to make some adjustments. So I'm going to make just a few concluding remarks on chapter 3 of Genesis, and then we'll get into chapter 4. We'll get into chapter 4 up to Cain killing Abel and then being exiled. Let me read chapter 4 just to have that in front of us. Chapter 4, 1 through 16, anyway. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, and said, "I have acquired a man from the Lord." Then she bore again, this time his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. So the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it." Now Cain talked with Abel, his brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" And he said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And he said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So now you are cursed from the earth, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. A fugitive and a vagabond you shall be on the earth." And Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Surely you have driven me out this day from the face of the ground. I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and a vagabond on the earth, and it will happen that anyone who finds me will kill me." And the Lord said to him, "Therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold." And the Lord set a mark on Cain, lest anyone finding him should kill him. Then Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden. So just a few concluding or postscript remarks on Genesis chapter 3. I said we'd come back and look at the connection between the covenants that God, the coverings that God made for Adam and Eve and the atonement. But there's another place where I can probably bring that in, so I'm going to kick the can down the way a bit. But there were just a couple of things to say about the covering. And I think I said this briefly, but I want to repeat it just to drive it home. If nakedness were the only problem there was, then presumably God wouldn't have thought it expedient or necessary to slaughter an animal and then make skin coverings for them. So nakedness alone is not the issue. One would think that fig leaves would be able to do the job, unless nakedness really is the issue. And it's just that Adam and Eve taking fig leaves isn't enough, so God takes something and even fig leaves. But there's something very, very obvious about the fact that an animal is slaughtered and then they are given clothes made out of those skins. But there's also a connection between nakedness and unrighteousness, right? God slaughters the animal, so you have shedding of blood. And if you think about Hebrews chapter 9, verse 22, according to the law, this is quoting now, according to the law, says the writer of the Hebrews, almost everything that requires purification for the temple service is purified with blood. For without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. Now, I also want to include in there that word, that Greek word translated remission into English, ophesis, is used in the Greek translation of the Old Testament in Hebrews 61:1, where the passage refers to proclaiming release to the captives. That word release or liberty is ophesis. So there's also a connection between the remission and the shedding of blood. So I wanted to point that out, because just reading it on its face, the connection, I think, between sin and the necessity of shedding blood isn't quite obvious. Then the other thing I want to point out is the connection between clothing and righteousness or unrighteousness. We should point out, not only did Adam and Eve need to have their bodies covered now because they'd lost that original righteousness, but when you think about the connection between clothing and righteousness, God, who is holy, 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 is never depicted in Scripture, if you will, naked. He's always depicted being clothed with something, obviously not not thread, not garment, clothed in majesty, clothed in light. If you want to read this yourself, Psalm 93:1, he's clothed in majesty, and then Psalm 104, verses 1 through 2, he's clothed with honor, majesty, and light. And then furthermore, when we get to the book of the Revelation, the martyrs coming out of the tribulation are not depicted as going back to that original pristine, naked lifestyle in the garden. They're given garments that have been made white in the blood of the Lamb. And then the Lamb himself is also depicted as being clothed with a garment that is white. So an animal is slain, and God makes covering from the carcass of the animal, at least from the skin of the animal. And if we're tracking here, if the earth is the temple, then the garden is something of, or perhaps even is, the Holy of Holies. So, pardon me. God slaughters the animal, clothes Adam and Eve, and then kicks them out of the garden. So the slaughtering and the coverings are taken place and made within the garden, within the Holy of Holies. And then once he's exiled them, he's placed the two cherubim at the door to guard the entrance. And then the flaming sword to guard the way towards the tree of life. That's all I wanted to say with regard to chapter 3. Are there any questions? Something that's just burning a hole in your heart that you... All right. Then let's consider... I like this tablet, but every now and then I pick it up and it opens up something that... So let's consider then, diving right into it, what Eve says about Cain. This fascinates a lot of people. Clearly fascinates me. I never talk about this passage without pointing this out. Verse 1 of chapter 4 says, "Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain and said, 'I have acquired a man from the Lord.'" Kaniti ish et yifah. I have acquired a man. Literally, I have acquired man, the Lord. As I'm looking around, I see familiar faces from the sermon I preached whenever I preached the last one. And I pointed out the fact that the grammar here, just reading it without trying to get into Eve's mind, the grammar here of what she says could indicate that she believes not only that she's given birth to that promised seed from Genesis 3:15, but also that promised seed is Yahweh, Yifah. And so hence she says, Kaniti ish et Yifah. There's a Targum Jonathan on this passage, or a commentary from the Hebrews, or Jews rather. It says, "And Adam knew Hava, his wife, who had desired the angel, and she conceived and bare Cain, and she said, 'I have acquired a man, the angel of the Lord.'" So not, I don't want to say it's not unusual. It's not out of left field for someone to think when Eve gave birth to Cain, and she thought that she had given birth to the promised seed, and then also that the promised seed was Jehovah. Because remember, when God made the promise of that seed, he wasn't even talking to Adam. So one indication is that Adam's not going to have anything to do with the seed. Now, objections say, well, the passage clearly says that Adam knew his wife, Hava, Eve, and then she conceived. And that's true. That's what the passage says. The passage doesn't tell us what Eve thought is going on. Adam knew his wife, she conceived. I suppose subsequently she knew, no, that's not the seed, and no, he's definitely not Yahweh. But at least at that moment that's recorded for us, Moses, the author, is telling us Adam knew Hava, she conceived. But we don't know exactly what Eve thinks. What we do know is what she says. And what she says is, I have acquired a man, the Lord. Calvin and others, I'll put it this way, most of the objections have to do with speculations about what is going on in Eve's mind, what she should have known and therefore did know. And I'm not saying definitively that this is the case. What I do want to point out is that the grammar, just on its face, tells us a couple things. That Eve thought Cain was the seed, and that she thought the seed was somehow or another identified with Yahweh. That's what we know just from the text, whether she was right or whether she was wrong, what she should have known. But then we also know, just not just from what the narrator says, because remember, Eve isn't reading Genesis chapter 4. You know, not to be flippant, but Eve's living this. Now, later on, somebody is narrating the event. So you have the narrator. No, Moses tells us Adam knew Eve, his wife. Presumably, yes, Adam and Eve probably knew the connection between sexual intercourse and conception. But again, we don't know beyond what Moses says about the act of conception. We don't know beyond that what's going on in Eve's mind. And again, what we do know is what she says. Any questions there on that? One of the reasons for focusing in on what she says here about the man being Yahweh is in the Hebrew, Kaniti ish et Yahvah, that particle there, et, usually, really close to saying always, but you always have to be careful with grammar no matter what language you're dealing with, except for Spanish, which is perfect. My Hebrew teacher would say, no, Hebrew is perfect because it's a language of heaven. And if you wanted to get an A, you did not respond back with, it doesn't sound perfect. It looks like a cricket hopped across the page. All right. In verse 1 of chapter 4, when it refers to Adam knowing his wife, or rather knowing Eve, yada et hava. So you have that particle there, et hava, where the direct object receives the action of the verb, right? So Adam knew, yada, Eve, et hava. So then you get to after Cain is born, and she says, kaniti ish et yivah. You have that same construction. We've got the et, the particle that marks the direct object. So again, I think another objection is that someone wanted to say, well, that construction there, the ish et yivah, could mean that that she was saying she acquired a man of the Lord in the sense of a man of God, like a prophet. But then the only problem there is, not that it can't be the case, but the only problem there is that particle, et yivah, again. Normally you wouldn't find, in a construct relationship, you wouldn't find something in between the two nouns that are in that construct relationship. So if it were going to be man of Yahweh, then we would expect ish yivah. Or if it's man of God, generally what you find, where you find in the scriptures, when you read the phrase man of God, it's usually ish Elohim. But you don't find that particle that marks a direct object when you have two nouns in a construct relationship. And construct relationship is a relation between two nouns that in English translations would anticipate the preposition of. So if we were looking for man of God, we could see ish Elohim. We wouldn't expect anything like ish et Elohim or anything else. Probably just really excites me to talk about Hebrew grammar. Anything else before we move on to the two men and their two sacrifices? No? Okay. That was probably about 5 more minutes of Hebrew grammar than you really woke up anticipating. No? I was thinking last night as I was doing this, it's like every week I end up saying something like this. To pursue this word further would require a Sunday school lesson all by itself, right? And I don't even like Hebrew. All right.
So are you, if I can ask a question?
Yes.
Are you saying that she was thinking that it was a completion of Genesis 3:15?
What she says is at face value, yeah, it that she seems to believe that here's the seed, and it's Yahweh. That may not be what she's thinking, but that's what the grammar seems to indicate, is that she was thinking this is the seed, and that it's Yahweh. Other translations, you probably have something like, I have begotten a man with the help of the Lord. Okay, that is legitimate. That going back, thank you for asking that question. I was thinking there's something else I wanted to say that didn't make it in my notes. Where you do find that sort of relationship between two nouns, et yivah, in that construction, does connote the possibility that whoever is identified by the second noun was of some assistance to whomever is speaking. So in that sense, she could very well be saying, when she says Kanita Ish et Yavah, she could actually be saying, I have acquired a man with the help of the Lord, or even from the Lord. So if you have those two translations, that's fine. I'm not wanting to be dogmatic. I'm just saying, when you read the Hebrew and you see that construction, it is interesting. And then as I read that passage from Targum Jonathan, it's not just Christian readers of the Hebrew who find that grammar instructive. Thank you. That was an important reminder that I wanted to take that up. See what I mean? Word study every Sunday. So we got two men and two sacrifices, Cain and Abel. Abel is a keeper of sheep, roeh, tzon. And that's going to be important here in a minute. He offers the firstlings of the flock with the fat thereof. Note, I'm sure you all remember when we went through Leviticus, because that was a rip-roaring good time too. That is how the burnt offering is referred to, right? Not just it's the firstling with the fat. And generally that language would indicate that what you're talking about here is a burnt offering. Cain's offering is what, if you go through Leviticus, would be termed a grain offering. Now, probably you're thinking, that's all well and good, but that's Leviticus. We're here in Genesis. I'll get to that in a minute. So I'm saying Cain's offering has all the appearance of a grain offering. If you want to note these passages, you can go back and read them later. Leviticus chapter 2, verses 1 through 16, and then Leviticus chapter 2, verses 1 through 16, and then Leviticus chapter 6, verses 14 through 18. Now, the difference in these two sacrifices might not get our attention right away, but bear in mind that this is part of the Pentateuch, and while a lot of things are perhaps not so clear while Moses is writing the Pentateuch, once he gets done writing, you've got a completed and whole book, so that we don't read Genesis after the completion of the canon at that point. The completion of the canon at that point is just the first five books of Moses. So when the canon is completed at that point, we don't simply read Genesis as Genesis, Exodus as Exodus, Leviticus, and so on, right? They have to be read in terms of each other. Now we have a relatively, at that point in the progress of redemption or the unfolding of Revelation, we have at that point, at least temporarily, a complete canon, so that the books need to be understood in terms of each other. And when you are learning the law, I don't know exactly when this became the rule, but certainly by the time of the rabbis, the first book that a rabbi had to master was not Genesis, but Leviticus, because of all those cleanliness restrictions. And even today, when you listen to debates between Jewish rabbis, they're all about the cleanliness restrictions. It kind of makes sense, right? There's no debate amongst rabbis as to whether adultery is okay. They seem to have that one down, but they have lots and lots of debates on how to properly observe all their holidays, Rosh Hashanah, the Passover. They have hours and hours of videos on the proper way to, now I can't remember the name of the word, which is okay, because once I do, I probably won't remember how to describe it either. But all their ceremonies, all their holidays, their very precise rules about how to do everything, and they actually argue about which of them is actually following the rule. So they're very keen on on the cleanliness. They're very keen on all those Levitical requirements. And so the first book that a rabbi would have mastered would have been Leviticus. That being the case, if you've mastered that book and you come to this passage, you've got Abel offering a firstling of his flock with the fat thereof, and then Cain offering from his work. What you have is one guy offering what would be understood what would be understood as a burnt offering, and then you have another man offering what would be understood as a grain offering. The reason I'm pointing that out is the nature of the offerings is, or at least appears to be, relevant. Number one, Moses thinks it's worth pointing out. And Moses is the guy, as you probably know, wrote Leviticus. So Moses thinks it's worth pointing out. So if it's worth pointing out, and it's okay to read Genesis understanding the Levitical law, then it's important to understand that you can't offer your grain offering before or even without a burnt offering. Because the grain offering isn't expiatory. It doesn't deal with sin. The burnt offering does, and the burnt offering does because it involves the shedding of blood. And getting back to Hebrews 9:22, without the shedding of blood, there's no remission. So there's no remission of sin. So Cain shows up with grain, which would be otherwise okay if he had first offered his burnt offering. An objection would be that until you get to that point, you don't have any instructions regarding the offerings. So if you read, we read Genesis 1, 2, and 3, no place there did we have any instructions regarding any burnt offerings. The first sacrifice of any note that we see is when God slaughters an animal to make skins. But anyway, when God chastises Cain about his sin, he could be understanding as saying that by virtue of bringing a grain offering rather than, I don't know, trading some grain with his brother for another firstlings of Abel's flock, instead of bringing grain, he should have brought a burnt offering, because by bringing grain, he wasn't dealing with his sin. That's what he chastises Cain for. You're not dealing with your sin. This is chapter 4, verse 6. So the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it." Now you contrast this with what Hebrews 11 says about Abel, that Abel offered a better sacrifice by faith. So the implication, if we look back at Genesis from Hebrews, would be actually the difference wasn't the sacrifices. It's that Abel showed up and he offered his sacrifice in faith. Cain showed up and he offered his sacrifice rather perfunctorily. It's just something we do. Here's my grain. Anyway. In reply to that, I would ask you to consider this. The possibility that it was showing up with a firstling of his flock together with the fat that demonstrated Abel's faith. Because what a faith are we talking about? We're talking about faith in God's promise, right? At that point, it's the promised seed. And why do we need the promised seed? Sin. Right? There's a sin issue. So Abel shows up with what would effectively be a burnt offering, if we can take a Levitical understanding to this passage. Abel shows up with what would be considered a burnt offering. And that's an act of faith because he knows he has sin to deal with. Cain, who probably thinks he's the seed, right?
And Abel probably does too.
Wouldn't know. Abel means vanity. Right. I mean, was he born so much later than Cain that by the time Cain's an adult, she goes, "Oh, that's not it." All right, newborn son, you're vanity. There's no way you're the seed because... Anyway, obviously speculating. Anyway, if Cain thinks he's the seed, then he gets a rude awakening. Maybe that's why he's in it. I'm the seed. Number one, why do I have to show up with a burnt offering? And you know, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm not too sure why I need to show up with any offering. I am the seed. Where's the serpent so I can crush his head? So anyway, getting back to Hebrews 11, the fact that Abel shows up with what would effectively be a burnt offering would be as demonstrable of his faith as if he had showed up with grain, still thinking that he had some sin to deal with. But when you think about what God says to Cain, sin lies at the door. You're not dealing with your sin. And I think the implication, taking the Pentateuch as a whole, is that the demonstration that Cain isn't dealing with his sin is he doesn't think he needs to show with a burnt offering. A grain offering is totally acceptable. I mean, obviously, we spent probably more time on the grain offering than anybody here really cares to try to remember. Totally okay to present a grain offering. I'm sure God is glad I agree that it's okay. It's probably not the best way to express myself. Anyway, it's totally okay to present a grain offering, but when sin is the issue, it's not okay. Any questions?
Yes. The fact that we don't see any instructions to them to bring a burnt offering, but then you didn't answer that problem.
Why they're doing it?
Yeah.
Well, the only thing we can do is speculate that by that time, Adam at least had an idea. This is how we're going to approach God. And probably, I think this is also speculation, but you think about getting kicked out of the garden, how far away from the garden would you think they'd go?
Not very.
And right, and so, especially because when Cain is exiled, he's described in moving east of Eden, which is where the garden is. So however close they are to the garden itself, they're still in Eden, wherever that is. And it seems like a reasonable assumption that they are probably presenting their offerings at the entrance to the garden. So, you know, obviously we can only speculate, but it seems reasonable that Adam had said, okay, this is how we approach God now.
I think it's reasonable, again, speculation, that the animals that God clothes them in is probably fairly lamb-like or sheep-like, I would think.
You know, I just wish Genesis 3 said that. Solved so many problems. So many problems.
What was the grain offering for?
Pardon?
What was the grain offering for?
Like in the Levitical rules?
Well, just briefly.
Any it could come in a raw form. But it had to be the best of your grain. So if you raised grain, then it had to be the best of the grain you had. If you didn't want to bring grain, then it had to be baked. It had to be mixed in with olive oil, made into cakes, baked, and then it could be presented. Then it could be presented that way.
And what was it for?
Any offering to God, to offer to Him from our, like a tithe. It could be Thanksgiving, but it was never offered without a burnt sacrifice first. People welling up with gratitude to God for success, show up with a grain offering.
Well, so that's more of a Thanksgiving offering as opposed to a burnt offering, which is for sin.
Right. And that's what I said. Ordinary, on all of the things being equal, nothing wrong with the grain offering. Nothing wrong with Cain showing up with grain. There is something wrong when you show up with a grain offering, but no burnt offering. And all this, by the way, is one of those reasons why. You remember we talked about that theory of authorship of the Pentateuch, where it's broken up between four or five different guys, a J author and an Elohist. That is one of the reasons why that sort of holds, because here you have in this passage language about sacrifice that would be very important to the priestly class, right? And one of the documents is P. It's supposed to be the priestly document. And that's why there's this idea that what we have in the Pentateuch is a single document that's actually been woven together by several. But it's also one of the reasons why we need to understand each of the books of the Pentateuch in terms of each other. Number one, that's how you interpret any document, is by cross-referencing things. Oh, those are good questions. Anything else?
Just for if people want to read it, Leviticus 7, 11 and following is your peace offering, which talks about the cakes. And then there's some first fruits offerings in Leviticus 23. So it's all in there.
Volume? Yeah?
Well, just you mentioned it, and it's a detail that doesn't jump right out immediately, but when they left the garden, they left out of the east.
Yeah.
And then later, when the tabernacle is established, it seems like a completely obvious connection, because they're going to go from east to west. It's a reenactment of coming back into the presence of God. And to make your point, it's like, you can't do that until you sacrifice. And then your grain offerings have their place. And in some of the ultimate picture, you're going to take that grain and you're going to make bread out of it, and you're going to commune with God in the holy place.
Yeah.
And so Abel's got all his cards and horses flipped around. And the question is whether he knew that or not.
Do you mean Cain? Cain had his court? Okay.
Yeah, whether Cain knew that or not.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think later it becomes clear that there's a drama being enacted that's important that you do it right and a good intention in doing it right.
Yeah, like Nadab and Abihu, right? They did it wrong.
Yeah.
You know, it was strange fire. It was probably enthusiasm. I think you could conclude, because they offered strange fire, that they did so carelessly. But on the other hand, it could also be something that was offered just out of enthusiasm. And bad news for, well, I won't name groups, but enthusiasm really, depending upon how it works out, isn't one of God's favorite human emotions, because we usually end up doing some of the last things we should do when we're coming from a place of enthusiasm. But on the other hand, they might also have had something to drink, because down below, after that, is you get a reiteration of don't be drinking. You have something.
So in my commentary, it talks about basically after the promise of the seed crushing the serpent's head, that there's a manifestation of that evil almost instantly with Cain killing Abel.
Yeah.
But if it's possible that Cain thinks he's the seed, but he's not, but then he kills Abel, does he think Abel's the seed of the serpent? You know, I mean, it starts to get all super connected and kind of ironic, like he's completely wrong.
Yeah.
But
well, even how God approaches him sounds very garden-like.
Yeah.
It basically says, you've got it all wrong. So then he goes out and does it all wrong.
Yeah.
You know, years ago when I first started hearing somebody talk about the importance of the actual sacrifice, because for the most part, especially in Protestant circles, I think also in the Roman Catholic Church, because I actually paid attention to Sister Maria Teresa when she was teaching, that there was no real attention to the sacrifices of them both. It was the heart condition, which is good. Obviously, there is, because God is chastising Cain for his anger. But years after my own conversion, and then especially when I came into Protestantism, the first time I heard somebody say, let's slow down and think about these sacrifices, it was either my internal reaction or the teacher I was listening to. But at some point, one of us said, and so Cain's killing of Abel seems to be Cain's way of saying, okay, you want blood? Okay. I'll offer you some blood. Ain't Cable so good? It doesn't get more innocent blood than this guy. So let me give you this guy's blood. Okay, there's nothing in the passage that says that. It just says Cain got angry and killed his brother. Anything else real quick? Okay, try to help me keep the speculations to a minimum, people. You're going to get me in trouble. You know these things are being broadcast later. My mom listens to this, for crying out loud. Hi, Mom. Okay, so Moving on now, after Cain killing Abel, there are a lot of parallels in this story with the fall and subsequently. So here's some parallels, but also contrast. So here, just a brief listing of some of them. So Cain sins, and he attempts to hide his sin. His punishment involves a curse and exile. Contrasting, Cain attempts to hide his sin, but when found out, if you think about it, he doesn't really admit anything. Of course, he doesn't have to. He's been found out. Adam tries to hedge his bets a little bit. This woman you gave me to be with me, which makes it kind of your fault, she gave me the fruit. More closely, in Genesis 3, God asks Adam, "Where are you?" In Genesis 4, God asks Cain, "Where is your brother?" Adam responds to God by telling him why he hid himself. Cain responds with sarcasm. "Didn't know it was my day to keep up with him. I have no idea where my brother is. Did I become his keeper suddenly?" And I think that's the same word. I think it's ruah. Abel is a ruah tzon, but I forgot to double check. That may actually be the same word where Cain says to God, "Am I my brother's keeper?" Anyway, but also in Genesis 3, God curses the ground. Here's a contrast. God curses the ground in Genesis 3, but he curses Cain in Genesis 4, picking up at verse 11, Genesis 4. "So now you are cursed from the earth, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. A fugitive and a vagabond you shall be on the earth." And Cain, okay, this is just overly whiny. "And Cain said to the Lord, my punishment is greater than I can bear." He only killed his brother. "Surely you have driven me out this day from the face of the ground. I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and a vagabond on the earth. And it will happen that anyone who finds me will kill me. And the Lord said to him, therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord set a mark on Cain," probably a nose ring, "lest anyone finding him should kill him. Then Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden." So he moves further out. And Nod, I think this is one of those places, he doesn't go there because it's called Nod. It's called Nod because he went there, because the word comes from the same word for wandering. So he wandered in the place called Wandering. It's called Wandering because that's where he wandered. Okay, that closes us off here. It closes us off with this portion of chapter 4. We'll take up next time with the genealogies of Cain and Adam. Questions? Comments? As always, complaints must be submitted by email so that I can ignore them more effectively. All right, let's pray, and then we'll prepare for worship. Our Heavenly Father, we ask that you will quiet our hearts and our spirits so that we may prepare ourselves to worthily magnify and glorify your holy name through Christ our Lord. Amen.